viable source of income for the country.
The world is shifting toward new and strategic technologies. Our country, too, is treading on the same path. Genetics and its associated technologies have numerous applications. They are a major factor in advancing our space program. So, we invited major brands to this expo to help us achieve our goals by advancing genetics in our country.
Organizers say during the 4 days of the second Geomatics exhibition, B2B meetings will be organized between investors and manufacturers. The event will also hold workshops for startups to acquaint them with the needs of the market.
Without Geomatics, many businesses such as online ride-sharing services would not exist. Experts here say the range of applications of this discipline is growing even wider, and this will attract larger investment to this field in the near future. They say this global trend is already happening in Iran. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here, at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who is an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process.
Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the Met, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The force Commissioner Rowley commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyper is up, London.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kiev and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP/T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP/T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, tempers are running high in Pakistan over the repeated Islamophobic incidents by some European countries in recent days. Outraged Pakistanis took to the streets of the capital Islamabad after Friday prayers to condemn the West for what they call its malicious anti-Islamic agenda.
Burning of Muslims' holy book by these Western nations proved that Islamophobic acts were not an expression of freedom of speech, but extremism. Sadly, extremism exists and is growing everywhere in Europe. It's time for European nations to think about who's promoting extremism by desecrating other religions.
Protesters chanted slogans and vented their anger against the silence of the West regarding repeated incidents of desecration of Holy Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. Demonstrators also called on Muslim nations to boycott European goods over what they describe as the West's insolent behavior.
We strongly condemn the blasphemous incident of desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The incident is the worst and most heartbreaking act in Europe. There is no room for such a sad incident in a civilized society.
Demonstrators are demanding that the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, known as OIC, raise its voice against the growing intolerance against Islam and anti-Muslim acts across the globe.
It's time for the OIC to play its role in urging Muslim nations to stand united against Western conspiracies. Europe wants to ignite Muslims by doing such blasphemous acts. Once we are united, Europe will not dare to repeat such Islamophobic acts.
The countrywide rallies came days after Pakistan denounced what it described as the abhorrent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden and the Netherlands, saying such acts disrespect Muslims across the globe.
Condemnations continue to pour in from Muslim countries across the world. Yemen, Qatar, along with other Islamic nations, joined Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey to denounce the desecration. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
People of Afghanistan are extremely upset about the deplorable and shocking act of some extremist individuals in Sweden and Holland in desecrating the Holy Quran, which is taken as a disrespect towards not just the Holy Book of Muslims, but all Holy Scriptures, by tearing the Holy Quran and setting it on fire. The primitive and uncivilized act of a bunch of radical elements in Europe has raised robust condemnation from Afghan people against such abominable act.
They claim human rights and still burn the Holy Quran. It looks like it's only for themselves. We want the Swedish government to punish the perpetrator of this action and also ask Islamic countries to be united against this action.
Even when such people insult the Holy Quran, the book's value increases for us. If we are not burning their holy books in response today, it is because of the teaching of the Holy Quran to have a peaceful relation with all people.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has also condemned the awful action and called for punishment of its perpetrators in Sweden and Holland.
We ask the government of Sweden to punish the perpetrators of this crime and do not let such individuals to act in provocative and heinous ways against the holy books.
The Holy Quran is simply a fundamental element to unite Muslims, so that Afghan politicians from various groups and ethnicities, including former administrators and current statesmen at the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, break ranks with the disgusting radical act towards the Holy Book committed by some extremist groups in Europe, and roundly condemned the disgusting act under the guise of freedom of speech. The Afghan politicians unanimously announced that the spirit and essence of coexistence of ideas and thoughts is definitely on the line, then on. During the protest, people of Afghanistan have called for the unity among believers of all Ibrahimic religions towards such targeted attacks, which have mainly aimed at weakening believing souls and freedom seekers of the entire world, and not just Islam and Muslims. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
and a supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Five Memphis police officers pummel a black man with kicks, punches, and baton blows over a traffic stop violation that was alleged. Days later, the man dies in the hospital. An all-too-familiar scene in the U.S. which is plagued by police violence. This time, though, five officers were also black. In the meantime, Americans held rallies in different cities and towns, including in Memphis, to protest the police heavy-handed tactics. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how police violence in the U.S. continues to claim lives, and why police brutality appears enshrined in the police's conduct in the U.S. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Wilma Leon, political analyst, joins us from Washington, D.C. And Frank Emspach, Workers Independent News, joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Wilmer Leon, I'll first start with you, and I'm sorry, but I want to recount the death scene with you based on this unfortunate man, Nichols, who was pulled out of the car. Have you seen the video, by the way, Wilmer Leon?
Yes, I have.
I know it's very rough, but again, I have a purpose behind asking you relaying this again or recounting this scene again. Nichols pulled out of the car for an alleged traffic stop, pushed to the ground, and then he was beaten and pepper sprayed multiple times. And then later on, we saw the scene in the hospital of which he died then, I guess a few days later. And the reason for his death was deemed to be extensive bleeding caused by a severe beating. I need to get your reaction on this and as to how you saw the way that the police went ahead with the violence that they executed on this young man. And as to why you think they went at it the way they did.
Well, I think I can start with the latter part of the question first. They went at it in the manner in which they did because they brought a certain perspective, a certain approach, a certain mindset to the scene in the first place. This Scorpion team, as they're called, supposedly responsible for targeting crime in a particular area, and particularly felony types of crimes. And in many neighborhoods, they're called jump out squads. And what tends to happen is a groupthink, is a dog pack mentality, and that's what you saw exhibited on the video that you witnessed, because they brought the escalation to the scene. There was nothing that Tyree Nichols did that A, warranted the traffic stop in the first place, and then B, once the traffic stop was being executed, there was nothing that he did that would have caused an escalation to the level of violence that we saw. The level of violence basically began as soon as this traffic stop began. So that tells me that they had a particular predilection. They had a particular predisposition to engage in this behavior. And one of the reasons I believe that they do this in this manner is to send a message to others in the community that this is our neighborhood, these are our streets, you are under our occupation, and we don't care what you say, how you think, how you feel, what you do. We run these streets, and you are basically subservient to us. That's the message that groups of these types, that's the message that Chauvin was sending in his approach to George Floyd. It had less to do with George Floyd and more to do with sending a message to those bystanders of who's in control of the situation.
Well, that's a pretty heavy point. Do you agree with the point that's made there by our guest, Frank Emsbach?
Yes, I do. I think it goes that these teams are trained to be super aggressive. They're trained to be very cohesive. They're trained to support each other. And so this kind of activity is what's going to happen. I think that what we've got, you know, throughout the United States in many, many cities are these SWAT teams and whatnot. This is 25, 30 years old. And it's fundamentally useless in terms of dealing with crime, but it's just crazy when it comes to traffic stops. We're talking about crime, so-called, that might at the most result in a ticket, not capital punishment. And so you have a system set up to have people who can kill people for a broken taillight or because the person is going 10 miles an hour over the speed limit. And so this is not some minor thing. In the United States in the last year, in 2022, police killed 1,096 people. That's a lot of people. Not all of them were traffic stops, obviously, but, you know, 1,000 people. That's a lot of people.
That figure I have as 1,176, depending on what source you have. Mapping police violence is what I have as. Go ahead.
Yeah, 1,001. I have the mapping police violence number, and the number I have in 2022 is 1,185. So, you know, we're within the margin of error of the survey.
Oh, okay. Well, the reason why I said that even is because every human life counts. Now, obviously, it makes it the deadliest year on record for 2022. And to go along with that stat of what I have compiled here, it's interesting how the characterization then is placed on the U.S. police when this stat is mentioned based on this one particular source, Wilmer Leon, where it says the U.S. police has killed more people compared to any other industrialized democracy, with a disproportionate number of people shot, and those are people of color. It's an interesting description there. What do you think of it?
Well, look, you have a whole system in this country of...
I'll come to you, Wilmer Leon. Frank M. Spack, go ahead.
We have a whole thing in this country of racism. I mean, this is not anything to debate anymore. The only thing they didn't mention yesterday was driving while black, which in this town, Madison, Wisconsin, was a real issue where you have a disproportionate number of black drivers on the street near our house here being arrested for traffic stops for basically nothing. And this happens, this is pervasive throughout our society. And the 1,000 people killed or 1,100 people killed is a reflection, and the racial differentiation there is a reflection of a society that has had a system starting of slavery, you know, and for, 300 years. And so you're going to have all of those negative aspects, all of those things where people are treated not as human being, as part of a culture. And that culture is exacerbated and pushed when you put together people in a hyper-aggressive, small unit police force.
The reaction now taken in terms of a particular response, Wilmer Leon, again, I need to ask you this, is that, and it's presented as a solution, I think, where they have deactivated the unit that these five officers worked in. Do you think that that is going to solve the problem?
Oh, not at all, because the problem is endemic in the zeitgeist of America. This is who America is. This is a domestic representation of what the United States does internationally. This is what you're seeing play out in American cities is what America did in Iraq. It's what America is trying to do in Iran. It's what America did in Afghanistan. It's what America did in Vietnam. It's what America did in Grenada. This is how America deals with its issues. If crime is the issue that's trying to be addressed, crime is a reflection of poverty. Crime is not something that is inherent in a particular culture, group of people, in a particular ethnicity. Crime is a reflection of poverty. So if you deal with crime, you don't generate squads, you deal with poverty. You raise people out of poverty. You don't send $70 billion to Ukraine, you send $70 billion to Madison, Wisconsin, to Memphis, Tennessee, to Oakland, California. You create jobs, you create a life in a culture that has meaning and value. You don't just impose more force upon a defenseless group of people.
Well, what has the U.S. government done here, Frank M. Speck? I think at Joe Biden's $30 billion funding force, it included, unlike what our guests there said, included funding police officers on, and it called for the expansion of accountable community policing. Now, is that not a good amount, or is that not a good approach by Biden, and why has it not worked?
I don't, look, Let's try this. Are somebody a criminal because they go out and they beat somebody on the head? Of course. The front page of the New York Times today, a drug company stole $144 billion by manipulating the patents on Humira drugs. Who's the criminal? Okay, so there's that whole aspect of what is criminality. In terms of policing, think about it. You're trying to stop, in theory, you know, people creating, you know, doing violent crimes or something. And you're going to do this by driving around the city and hopefully see something, maybe, and or if not, go arrest somebody who's driving. I mean, it makes no sense, and it doesn't work. Okay, that's the other part of this. But what works is community cohesion. And what works is, to an extent, is the proper people also being at the scene. One thing that could be done, even within the current framework, is for all kinds of domestic violence type calls and many, many others, you have trained mental health people, EMS type people coming to the scene. For traffic stops, as they have done in some cities, you disarm the people who are involved in the traffic stops, the police, so that at least you're not going to get somebody killed. Okay, so there are things that can be done. I don't see any of that thinking in Biden's budget, but it's possible. There have been funding to try to have alternative routes to public intervention when you have something that you see, you know, like the domestic violence. And that may help. But the overall approach, if just putting money into the police worked, we'd be the safest country in the world because we put in more than anybody else consistently for the last 50 years. We have more people in jail than anybody else. So clearly, it isn't working.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Leon, can you please explain to us the defunding police call that's been made and why it is that calls are being made for that? What solution lies in that rather than funding the police or continuing to fund the police and maybe even fund it more? I'm trying to understand the voice from the two camps.
I wish that there were the term, I think, refunding the police, in my humble opinion, as a public policy person would make more sense. Defunding the police is a clever slogan, and it resonates well with a particular group of people. But as a policy, it doesn't really make a lot of sense because there's no clear definition in terms of what it means. I have interpreted this to mean, based upon a number of activists and people that I've spoken with, is that a lot of the resources that are going into police departments need to be redirected into better preventative measures so that you don't have things don't escalate to the point to where you need the police in the first place. There are also initiatives that are being generated that police forces need to be put into public safety organizations so that they work more cohesively with EMS, they work more cohesively with other elements in your government that deliver social services so that there's a cooperative effort instead of the police arriving on the scene as the be all and end all in a circumstance where mental health professionals may be needed as opposed to excessive force that unfortunately gets used by too many police officers. So again, defunding the police, it's a great slogan. It doesn't really have a definition. The definition varies depending on who you talk to. So I think a better explanation of it is refunding the police, directing those resources to places where public service and need would be better served.
Looking through the research material here, Frank Emspach, one of the things that perhaps one reads and may skim over it, but then come back to it because it's rather important, and I'd like to find out from you if it is or not, is the question that was posed where it's asked, what is the biggest problem facing police in the USA today? Now, you would think that it would be police violence, but what this particular source said was that currently police recruitment and then retention, it says, is arguably the largest problem facing the criminal justice system, and then referred to police. Isn't that, in a sense, very alarming? And if it is true, because to retain the police, doesn't it mean that they may grant them more leniency when it comes to the way they conduct themselves?
It depends why the police are leaving the police force, I suppose. The discussion in Memphis was that the county board or whoever the appropriate authority was went after the police pensions, and so the police left. So in other cases, you know, it's true that sometimes the police forces do not want the kind of scrutiny that they're getting. And in the Chicago case, for instance, the police chief there left as well and wound up becoming police chief in a town of 5,000. As opposed to a town of 2 million. But in any event, every single social service in this country is facing a crisis of hiring and replacement and training. The police may be more so than others. The question of funding, though, is crucial. The defund the police gave the right wing, at least in this state, a club to beat everybody over the head with. They said, we can't defund the police. You guys who are saying that, you know, or believe in crime and so on and so forth. And it was, I think, an unnecessary opening. What we need is the kind of comprehensive discussion that our other guest was talking about, that you have all kinds of things that go on that don't need the police, you know, per se. Well, you have evictions, you have family disputes, you have traffic stops, which are the least effective of anything. You know, so you have to change this. You have to have the kind of society where you're teaching from the beginning that all people are human beings. You can't have this continuing sort of cultural norm where there's a sense that some people are inferior and some aren't. Because once that happens, then you're not hurting somebody who's like you. You're beating up some animal, which is exactly the language that some of these people use. Mm-hmm. So it's a much deeper thing here than just the police techniques. And it's one that really needs to be addressed from a social perspective, from a broader perspective than just the technique of traffic stops.
I find it very interesting that even after all these years, you're still looking at the fact that this discrimination and the issue of color resonates or is so boldly displayed when it comes to police violence. Wilmer Leon, where it says Black Americans are most likely to experience fatal police violence. And there was a 40-year study, 1980 through 2019, where they were estimated to be 3.5 times more likely to die from police violence than white Americans. Why are we looking at this kind of disparity? Why are we looking at blacks being targeted that way? I don't know if I should use the word target, but they've been a victim, obviously, 3.5 times more than whites.
Because America is a racist country. It was founded on racism. Racism has been one of the elements that has fueled who America is, how America was built, and so it is inherent. Look at Ron DeSantis in Florida and he doesn't even want African-American studies to be taught in AP advanced placement courses in high schools in Florida. They are so afraid. Many conservative, particularly white Americans, are so afraid of telling the truth about who America is and what America does that they don't want these things taught in schools. And the only way that we're ever going to be able to move to the point that where Frank was talking about is this has to be taught. And let me give, a really quick example of something that I noticed in the tape of the beating of Tyre Nichols. Five officers involved in the actual physical contact, probably another five or six officers standing on the periphery watching what was going on, not intervening, and even failing to render aid. Mess shows the scene. Now that's the fire department. They don't do anything either. So what that says to me is there's a mindset that that goes throughout the public service response apparatus within Memphis. It's not only limited to the police department, it has made its way into the fire department and into the ambulance service as well.
All right, so we just have about a minute left here. Frank Imsbach. I think we don't have Frank Imsbach with us. Frank, are you with us?
If you study labor history, Memphis and the Memphis police force has been an outlier in viciousness for a couple of generations. That's number one. Number two, in terms of history, the vision of America is these small New England farmers working away and making the country great. The richest city per capita in the United States in 1830 and 1840 wasn't New York. It was Natchez, Mississippi, on the Mississippi River, because it was a trading in cotton city, slaves and cotton. That's where the wealth came from. And I don't think most people would say, what are you talking about? Who ever heard of that place?
Okay, last question that I can fit with you, Wilmer Leon. Quickly, if you can, under a minute, what is the worst case scenario that we're looking at when it comes to police violence?
You just saw it. And unfortunately, it replicates itself time and time and time again. It's Rodney King. It's George Floyd. We just saw it.
Okay, we'll end it there. Wilmer Leon, thank you. Political scientist from Washington, D.C. Frank Imsbach, a pleasure. Workers Independent News from Madison, thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitawe and the team, it's goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
ای
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember in the previous episode, we discussed the events leading to the acceptance of the United Nations Security Council Resolution 598 by the Islamic Republic of Iran after Imam Khomeini's permission. The resolution had in fact included some conditions for a just ceasefire of the Iraq-Iran war. We said that Iran had not accepted the former resolutions due to neglecting Iran's rights and being far from realities on the ground. Today, we are going to talk about the events before Imam Khomeini's passing away. Stay tuned, please. Nowruz of the new Iranian year 1368, March 1989, was a special event for the Iranian people as they were going to celebrate the first Nowruz after the end of the eight-year imposed war. Nowruz feast had coincided with the anniversaries of Imam Hussein, Hazrat Abbas, and Imam Sajjad, peace upon them. Hence, people had decorated the streets and alleys more than ever. According to the custom of every year, people were waiting to watch Imam Khomeini's live message on the new Iranian year. A few days earlier, the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting, IRIB, had suggested recording the Imam's message and broadcasting it as a live TV message. But Imam Khomeini didn't accept the suggestion, saying, "If I am alive, I will say the congratulation myself. But if I am not alive, this will be taken over by the next leader of the Leadership Council." The Imam's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, said on the issue after his passing away, "He would not accept even this much of dishonesty with people, so that the IRIB broadcast his pre-recorded message as live message." In those days, the Imam Khomeini's family was not that happy as the Imam was somehow ill. Lady Saghafi says, "I saw that the Imam had become weaker for a few days, and I noticed that he had gone to the clinic of Jamaran without informing me. I asked him, 'Why do you go to the clinic? What do they do with you?' He said, 'They take images from me.' I asked him, 'What has happened to you?' He said, 'My stomach was bleeding for a few days.' I was upset and told him, 'Why didn't you tell me anything?' He kept silent." Imam Khomeini's special physician, Dr. Arefi, heard of his illness, so he and his advisors started examining the Imam's stomach. Ms. Saghafi describes the issue. "Radiography began again, and one day it was clear that the Imam had been under the apparatus for long. So when he returned home, he was overtired. I realized that he had a tough time because I had experienced the exam a few years before and I knew how hard the exam was. So in order not to upset the Imam, I said, 'Inshallah, it is nothing and you will get better soon.' Yet I knew that a simple stomachache and even
temporary bleeding shouldn't urge doctors to do exams so many times. The imam didn't answer, and as it was the lunchtime, he ate a few spoons of the soup and went to his room to rest. The exams of physicians made them decide that Imam Khomeini had to undergo surgical operation. The imam's wife was opposed to operation because he was very weak and she was worried that he might not endure it. She continues, "I was informed of the imam's public health and said that there was no need for operation. I told Ahmad to ask the medical team to forget about surgery and told the imam, 'You are too weak and cannot endure surgery.' He said, 'What can I do when they all say that I should be operated?' Finally, the day after the exams, doctors got Imam Khomeini's permission to hospitalize and operate him. The imam was little satisfied to be operated, yet he surrendered to the view of physicians. Ms. Saghafi says, "That night, there was nobody at home except me and the imam. Ahmad Agha and his wife came before the dinner. They went before the dinner. I had no appetite to eat the dinner, and the imam ate just bread, yogurt, and cucumber. After the dinner, the brother, his daughter-in-law, Dr. Tabatabai, came. He was ready to accompany the imam to the hospital. I said, 'I entrust you to God.' The imam came out of his room and told me to lock the door and take its key." Imam Khomeini went to the hospital. Ms. Saghafi continues the story. "We had lived together for 60 years. We might be upset with each other at times, but the imam would tell me repeatedly, 'Be satisfied with me.' Imam Khomeini went so fast that I failed to reach him. I was near the door of the clinic when he went down the steps and bid me farewell. I told him goodbye and came back with Fatima." Imam Khomeini passed away 2 weeks after hospitalization. Every detail of the operation could be watched by the family as there were cameras at the operation section. They were praying sadly. The imam was under operation, but he didn't forget prayer and supplication. He didn't forget religious obligatory acts. Ms. Saghafi told him, "I have come with you whenever you have gone, so take me to paradise with yourself." He said with a smile, "Thanks a lot for always being with me, but in the hereafter, everyone is alone with their deeds."
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.